You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the spread of the novel coronavirus has raised questions about what types of testing and treatment could be covered by health insurance companies. We'll talk about what actions the president and Congress are taking and how effective they might be. Now, cyber attacks, both in terms of election interference on social media coming from countries like Russia and attempts to shut down things like utilities and financial systems, or a reported attack on the Health and Human Services website today, they're getting more attention from the federal government. Last year, a bipartisan group of lawmakers and experts were called to form the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, meant to identify the ways the U.S. could improve its cyber defenses. Now, the group is out with 75 recommendations, ranging from security requirements from the private sector to new federal positions dedicated to cyberspace. The co-chairs of the commission are Mike Gallagher, a Republican representing Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, which includes Green Bay, and Angus King, an independent U.S. senator from Maine. We talked to both of them last Friday. Representative Gallagher, before we get into some specific recommendations, big picture, as you look at these cybersecurity issues, how ready do you feel about our preparations here in the United States?
I think we've made important progress in recent years, but it has not gone far enough. And our government is currently not quick enough or agile enough to respond to a major cyber attack, let alone deter one from happening in the first place. And that's why this report is so important. And I was proud to work with Senator King on this effort. It is the culmination of over a year's worth of work. And it was truly bipartisan. This was not a left versus right thing. This is just all about how can we put ourselves in a position where we can deter malicious cyber actors from attacking us, and if necessary, respond with speed and agility in the wake of a massive cyber attack.
And Senator King, when people think foreign and cyber security, cyber interference, they might think Russia, 2016 elections, but that's just part of the story, right? Can you give a sense of the scope of the things we're talking about here?
Well, it absolutely is just part of the story. China has stolen probably in the hundreds of billions of dollars worth of intellectual property. If you Google the Chinese Air Force fighter plane, it coincidentally looks almost exactly like our F-35. Iran has a strong cyber force. They've attacked our financial sector. North Korea is building up in this area. And then there are non-state actors like, you know, terrorist organizations, individuals, just plain old garden variety crooks. So the cyber realm is really dangerous, and it's very vulnerable. We are the most wired country in the world, and that's the good news. The bad news is we're the most vulnerable. And Rob, before I jump off of that topic, I got to say, Mike Gallagher and I were co-chairs of this commission. We worked together every single week, two or three days a week on this for almost a year. He's a real gem and has done a fantastic job. Wisconsin's lucky to have him. This has been a really serious piece of work, and he's led us.
Representative Gallagher, you co-wrote a piece on our philosophy, our doctrine when it comes to cybersecurity. You said when we look at our nuclear doctrine, it centered around offense and massive retaliation to prevent attacks. And you write, that's not going to work here. You say we need to focus as much on defense and resilience. Can you make that case for us?
Well, I just perhaps would characterize it a little bit differently, okay. That it is a mix of both offense and defense. We need to maintain the tools to impose costs on our adversaries and go on offense. And indeed, a large part of what we're arguing for is building on this emerging doctrine of defend forward and persistent engagement and extending it across the federal government so we can respond very quickly when we see something bad happening in cyber. But you're right to suggest that I think what makes this unique and distinct from nuclear strategic deterrence during the Cold War is we are putting a lot of emphasis on deterrence by denial. How do we make ourselves into a hard target? How do we make sure we have plans ready to go to reconstitute our economy if we are hit with a massive cyber attack? So it's a mix of both, but we really are placing a lot of emphasis on how do we improve our defenses so that we're not incentivizing malicious cyber actors to attack us in the first place.
Senator King, can you tell us some of what that looks like in your commission's reports? What kind of concrete steps do we need to take to have that kind of defense?
Well, the first thing is to reorganize. The cyber responsibility for cyber is scattered all over the executive branch of the federal government and all over Congress. We sort of lost count at 50 different subcommittees and committees in Congress that have jurisdiction over cyber. So one of our first recommendations is the creation of a national cyber director in the White House. Senate confirmed a major position in order to bring some coordination and coherence to the overall cyber response capability in the federal government. By the same token, we propose the creation of two new committees in Congress exclusively devoted to cyber activities so that we don't have this crazy quilt of jurisdiction and it becomes almost impossible to get anything done in this area. So that's sort of on the organizational side. But we go, as I think Mike mentioned, we have 75 recommendations. We talk about the private sector that large public companies are going to, we're suggesting, need to be certified. They need to certify that they are cyber solvent as well as financially solvent, that they're protected, because about 80% of the cyber target in this country is in the private sector. Particularly the places like the electric grid, the financial sector, telecommunications, and that's where we're really in danger. And this is not an academic thing. I talked to a utility executive the other day. His system on this utility is hit 3 million times a day by malicious cyber actors. 3 million times a day. And I talked to a small bank here in Maine 100,000 times in a week on a small local bank. So this is no joke. And I don't know if you've had it in Wisconsin. We've had ransomware attacks against cities and town here in Maine. So what we're trying to do, Mike Gallagher came up with the best description of what we're doing here. And that is, we want to be the 9/11 commission report before 9/11.
And Representative Gallagher, another thing you talk about in that piece you wrote is the idea of resilience when attacks get through, big or small. Hopefully we stop them, but if and when they get through, how we pick up the pieces, as Senator King just said. What kind of recommendations does the commission have for that resilience capacity?
Well, taking our inspiration from the early Cold War in the mid-50s in the Eisenhower administration, we started to think through the unthinkable. We started to think about what would we do if we suffered a nuclear attack at the hands of the Soviet Union. And we developed things called continuity of government and continuity of operations. How would we continue to survive, to live another day and strike back in the event of that unthinkable event? Similarly, here we are recommending that the government immediately start planning for what we're calling continuity of the economy. Given that, as Senator King rightly pointed out, so much of the critical infrastructure in cyber is in the private sector, we really need the private sector in partnership with the federal government to start thinking now through what are the priorities in the event of a massive cyber attack. And then again, how do we ensure that we prevent that from happening in the first place by, for example, requiring public companies that are publicly traded to undergo mandatory penetration testing? So that's one of a variety of recommendations where we try to improve our resilient posture, and thereby try to signal to our adversaries that we are a hard target and a bad enemy, so don't mess with us.
Yeah, Representative Gallagher, that reminds me, and we keep having new smart products rolled out, refrigerators, appliances, whatever, and then we keep finding out about these huge security vulnerabilities in them that let them be used on denial of service attacks, other types of shenanigans online. Does there need to be some kind of cooperation with the industry to make sure they think security first as they roll out new lines of products?
We believe so, and it's one of the reasons that we are recommending enhanced cybersecurity certification requirements. There really does need to be a partnership, though, and a productive relationship. We really tried to thread the needle between incentivizing the private sector to step up, incentivizing those C-suite executives to really take cyber seriously, while not saddling them with a top-down approach or a set of onerous regulations that will put them out of business. And so that's a difficult balance to strike, but we believe it must be struck. We also are recommending, for example, in the context of how would we restart our economy, for those industries that are at the intersection of critical infrastructure or are systemically important, in many cases, they need to invest in analog systems and not have everything connected to the Internet of Things or or 5G and the invulnerabilities that come with that. So, for example, when we talk about election security, one of our strongest recommendations is that we recommend widespread use of paper balloting. And there's a bit of an irony there for a high-tech commission to be talking about the use of paper ballots.
Senator King, I want to take things to the international front for a moment. Representative Gallagher mentioned having that forward capacity. Now, if I'm another country, I might think, well, if you've got this cyber gun to my head, why shouldn't I maintain the same to you? Is there room for international negotiation to take some of these tools off the table for everybody?
Well, that's a great point. And one of our major recommendations is an increased international setting for trying to develop some consensus rules of the road in this area. We've had 1,000 years to develop sort of rules and customs and norms for warfare, like no chemical weapons, which by and large has been observed over the past 100 years. So the question is, can we do something similar for cyber? That has a couple of good effects. One is it's a deterrent to other countries for breaking internationally recognized rules. But if they do, then you've got the whole world to come down on them, not just one country. And sanctions and those kinds of things are much more effective if they're multiple countries are involved instead of just us or just one country. So the international piece, and we recommend that there be an assistant secretary of state just for this subject to work with our allies and everyone else to set the standards. And we ought to be taking the lead on this, because if we don't, China is going to be jumping in with both feet.
We'll watch for the results and the reaction to this commission report. Senator King, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you. I enjoyed it. As I mentioned, my wife's from Milwaukee, and it's always a pleasure to visit Wisconsin, if only electronically.
And Representative Gallagher, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be with you.
That was Republican Representative Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District and Independent Senator Angus King of Maine. We talked with them on Friday about their work with the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, which came out with 75 cybersecurity recommendations last week. Coming up, the astronaut diet is getting a shakeup thanks to a successful trial of growing lettuce in space. We'll learn more about what space gardening is like coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming out, we hear about some outrageous space news about a red romaine lettuce variety that's been grown at the International Space Station. Now it's been found safe to eat. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the simple joys of making tortillas.
Many of us have strong memories tied to making food with our families. Writer Araceli Esparza shares a poem about the bonds that are nurtured while making fresh, fluffy tortillas from scratch.
She gets the flour. She gets the flour and the salt. She gets the flour, the salt, and the water. Hungry for my cloud tortillas. Waiting feels like a year. The water, the flour, and the salt in a bowl. She begins. Hungry hunger rumbles in my tummy. She folds in the parts of my cloud and tells the dough how much I will love what it will become. Pitter-patter, thump-thump, everyone comes down the stairs. And now we all squeeze in to watch Josita, Tommy, Lupita, and even little Juanito. On the table, she rolls a little ball of masa. Will I get my own? Then she centers the masa ball on the tortilla press, pulls down the lid, and presses hard. Pat, pat with her manos. 5 kids watching, waiting. Will I get my own? Smack on the comal on the stove. Dale vuelta, tia. Give it a turn, tia. We whisper, shout. Little Juanito begins to whine. My cloud tortilla dream begins to evaporate. Couple of turns and browning. Bubbles form. Will they burn? My cloud tortilla was done all fluffy, light, and warm. Tia asks, who wants the first tortilla? Everyone answers, me, 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 me. But I say, yo, por favor. Tia gives me the puffy treat I've been waiting for, and I float to the ceiling. I spread a butter moon on top of my tortilla, but I see little Juanito, and I roll it up and give it to him, and I show him how the cloud eating is done.
That's Madison writer Araceli Esparza sharing a poem about making tortillas. I asked her why she wanted to write about food and her family.
I remember as a small child, like, going up to New Berlin with my great aunt and my grandmother and my mother and, like, all of us driving up there to visit her. They've known each other for so long, and, like, just her cooking and, like, the flour tortillas, oh my gosh, I never seen somebody, like, make them by hand. So when you go in Mexico, you typically see corn tortillas made in a machine, a tortilla, right? And so, but to see the process done by hand and then just the, it was so methodical and just so yummy. Oh my gosh, just like a slice of heaven.
So what have tortillas meant to you in your life?
You know, when I think about all the debates that's happening right now and what can bring us together, people often say breaking bread. Let's break some tortillas together, right? We can have country tortillas. We love our street tacos. Let's talk about that more and, like, let's talk to each other while we're breaking tortillas, maybe. I have tons of little tortilla stories about, like, one time I, like, you know, when you have an electric stove, like, okay, so I get kind of picky of how to cook them. Like, a gas stove tortillas are just so much better than an electric stove, right? But sometimes, okay, with electric stove, you have to really watch when you make them, and they can come up actually rubbery and hard. And so there's this anecdotal moment that I remember clearly with my grandmother, and I had an electric stove, you know, I was living in apartments and stuff, and, like, I make her these tortillas, and, like, she takes a bite and, like, literally throws it at me. Like, this is not quality, girlfriend. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she's like, I've taught you better. And I'm like, I'm dealing with an electric stove, abuelita, you know? This isn't, there's not a gas stove here.
Araceli Esparza is a writer based in Madison and host of the podcast Midwest Mujeres. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Tortilla, tortilla, necesitas una tortilla.
Now, when you're living on Earth, switching up your diet or enjoying some flavorful meals isn't too hard to accomplish, but if you're in space, it's a little more difficult. Prepackaged meals, not a lot of flavor. In a new study, though, researchers tried to find out if the outrageous variety of red romaine lettuce grown on the International Space Station was safe for human consumption. The results? Positive. Richard Barker is an astrobotanist and a researcher at the Gilroy Life Science Lab at UW-Madison. He's co-chair of the NASA Plants Advanced Working Group and a member of numerous other NASA Gene Lab collaborative working groups. He's a co-investigator on three NASA grants, has been involved in the planning and launch of multiple astrobotany experiments on the International Space Station. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
How big a deal is this news now? We knew they'd grown this lettuce, but now we know we can eat it. How big a deal is this?
Oh, this is tremendous news. My friend Joy has been working on this for many, many years. They've been doing a lot of ground testing, examining the microbial communities of various different lettuce samples from supermarkets and some they grew themselves in preparation. And after testing the plants on orbit, the astronauts were given the O-clear. Okay, and go ahead. And they ended up growing them and eating them on orbit.
Now, one of the big challenges, as I understand it, with growing things in orbit is everything that evolved on Earth evolved with gravity, and up there, not so much with the gravity. How much of a challenge is that?
Oh, that's a huge challenge. Like, agriculture has existed for thousands of years here on Earth, and so we've become incredibly efficient at growing plants to feed us here on Earth. But we've always had 1G gravity acting in order to help water drain through the soil. And so watering the plant turns out to be the most difficult thing to do in a microgravity environment.
What are the limits on an astronaut's diet right now that they're really hungry for some fresh produce?
Most of the food they eat is freeze-dried, and so they can be warmed up and rehydrated in orbit. But the things they really like to eat are things like shrimp cocktail because of the like umami flavoring, and it still really works well. And chocolate, of course. You can't go wrong with a good bit of candy.
Now, we've got lettuce. Are there other kinds of produce that seem like good candidates that might be in the works to try to grow on the space station?
Yeah, recently people just grew algae up there. For many years, people have been researching how you can biofortify algae to have all the micronutrients that you need. The problem is the algal wafers that you make to eat are a really weird thing. And it's surprising that food is the thing that makes you feel normal when you're in an alien environment. So they want the things that help them come back down to earth. Things like lettuce and tomatoes and things they had on the dining room table when they were younger, not algal wafers.
That sounds fair. Now, did I see somewhere, Richard? I thought I had heard that we might lose some of our taste buds, our perceptions, so we might actually be hungry for more flavorful foods in space.
Yeah, like your sense of flavor is definitely dulled because you don't have buoyancy-driven convection, so you don't have the mixing of gases, and so much of the flavor that we get is actually the aromas that come up as we tuck into our meal. In fact, the university researchers in the U.S. helped the European Space Agency by designing a very special type of coffee cup that would help the Italian astronaut drink coffee on orbit. While essentially still being able to smell all the flavoring coming off it. Best than drinking out of those plastic bags like they usually have to.
Now, you've gotten experiments run on the space station. I imagine those experimental slots are in really high demand. How hard is it to get your test from Earth and get it scheduled for the ISS?
Oh, it takes a long, long time. It takes about 4 years.
Wow.
After we've persuaded NASA to allow us to launch, to go through all the preliminary testings to get up there. Excitingly, we actually have an experiment up there right now.
Ooh.
We're testing the new spectrum analyzer. It's a new type of microscope that's being put up there. And so we're really excited because we have a telelink, so we're getting sent down some images of plants in orbit as we speak.
Fantastic. So what kind of plants might we, just briefly, might we be getting images of in the next day or so?
So we look at Arabidopsis thaliana, and so we put some genetically modified proteins in there to allow certain parts of the plant to glow in a different color. And so what we're hoping to do is see some of the stresses that the plants might encounter up there and see some of the responses that plants have to that using this genetic engineering technology.
Amazing stuff, Richard. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
That's astrobotanist Richard Barker with UW-Madison. Follow some of his work at the website astrobiology.botany.wisc.edu. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the latest discoveries about dinosaurs. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the spread of the novel coronavirus has put the issue of health insurance and the healthcare system front and center, but there's a lot of uncertainty in the conversation. President Trump and his team have talked about certain types of coverage guarantees and the ability to test and treat more Americans, but there are questions over when and whether those will become a reality. Philip Rocco is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He's author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, health insurance is never the easiest thing to understand, even in normal times. Now, especially, there's uncertainty about what is and isn't going to be covered when it comes to COVID-19 testing and or treatment. What are some of the areas of confusion you're noticing right now?
So one of the things, I think the first thing that happened was last week, Vice President Pence had this meeting with the CEOs of major insurance companies. And at the meeting, there was this implication that the companies had somehow agreed to cover the costs of testing, the out-of-pocket costs that people would experience when it comes to testing. And in fact, at that moment, the agreement was entirely clear on what the extent to which America's health insurance plans would cover. What exactly in terms of out-of-pocket costs they would cover. So it's worth thinking about this is that there's two separate things that you might expect your insurer to cover. There's the test, and of course, not everybody who might want to get tested is right now going to be sort of eligible for it because it's sort of limitations on the number of tests. But beyond the test, there's treatment. So any kind of treatment that you might receive if you are ultimately diagnosed for conditions related to coronavirus, pneumonia would be one of them. And when it comes to what insurers will cover, right now, there's actually not legislation that makes it a sort of blanket requirement that insurers cover the test. That legislation is still moving through Congress. It's been sort of pushed behind another bill in the Senate. We might see some action on it this week. But if the legislation were to pass as the House designed it, at the very least, what insurers would cover, no matter what insurer you had, Medicare, Medicaid, an employer self-insured plan under ERISA, or one of the larger group plans, they would cover the test, right? But that legislation hasn't passed, which means that what you're seeing around the country is that governors, I think including Governor Evers, have released executive orders that say that at the very least, group plans and Medicaid have to cover the test. Now, if you are like me, you have, and actually I think most people who have employer-sponsored insurance that is self-insured, which means that it's covered by ERISA, governors are actually not allowed to make laws or regulations related to those ERISA plans. So it's not surprising right now that I haven't actually gotten any notification from my insurer that the test is going to be covered. Now, if the House legislation passes, that won't be a concern. But again, that's sort of where we are, that there's right now not necessarily a guarantee that the out-of-pocket expenses from testing are going to be covered. Now, the other thing to note is that the legislation that is on the table does not touch the issue of treatment for people who ultimately have to go into hospital for conditions related to coronavirus. And that's really significant in part because the average cost, recent work out of the Kaiser Family Foundation health system tracker has suggested that the average cost of an admission for pneumonia is about $20,000. And the those without major complications could be a little bit lower, around $13,000. But even when it comes to cost sharing, out-of-pocket expenses could be pretty high, around $1,300 for an individual. And there's really a question about whether or not Congress is going to ultimately take that up. And if they don't, what are effectively we going to do? How are folks going to pay for it?
Well, you just laid it out there. We have a definite patchwork of kinds of coverage or lack of coverage in some cases. Does that, and of course, different laws from state to state for that matter, does that make it hard to have a federal policy that everybody can look, listen to what the president or vice president is saying, and say, yes, that's what it means for me?
I think the confusion that people will experience, again, you know, I have an employer-sponsored plan. I haven't necessarily gotten information about what's going to be covered under that. There hasn't been a lot of communication. That can be very confusing for people. But it, ultimately, we don't want this these sort of concerns to deter people from going to ultimately receive care, or if they are in a population that's particularly susceptible to corona to not get tested, right? And I think that that's, from a public health perspective, mm-hmm. that's one place where I think you can see the system really failing pretty miserably here.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University, looking at health coverage or lack of same, how it affects efforts to treat COVID-19, to stop the spread, to detect the disease, and to treat people who have come down with it. Phil, how big a part of the story is the part of the population without health coverage, citizens in some cases who don't have any kind of coverage, or in some cases undocumented people in the country who don't have access to any kind of coverage to begin with?
Yeah, I think that it's certainly the case that there are people who in our system fall through the cracks. Of the healthcare system. And I think that, you know, one thing that it would be, I think is really crucial here is, you know, what do we do for people who even after this legislation passes, you know, don't have insurance. And, you know, the one, I guess, sort of more optimistic note is that in the legislation that's currently working its way through Congress, it would allow state Medicaid programs to cover the testing, at the very least, even if people don't have Medicare or Medicaid, even if they don't have coverage through an employer or on the individual market, there would be money available for state Medicaid programs to cover the cost of those tests, which is, I think, from a public health perspective, is a very, very positive thing. Now, obviously, this is something that we probably wanted to have in place, you know, yesterday or last week or last month. And I think it's something that, because it wasn't in place, is beyond the sort of lack of availability of tests, I think it makes it hard to monitor and track the progression of the virus, which is, I think, why, at least per capita worldwide, the United States has the lowest number of people who have been tested per capita. So that's, I think, contributing to it. I think the other things that are contributing to it is this, you know, conflict between the federal and state governments on exactly what counts as a valid test. And, you know, there were some issues with the test that the CDC put out initially. There were some technical errors, and it didn't work initially. And, of course, there were some limits on the kinds of tests that state labs were developing, and the CDC didn't ultimately approve. But there's a real question over the sort of the custody and the putting the imprimatur on what counts as the test for COVID-19. And I think that the insurance story is a huge part of it, but I think we also can't lose a focus on the way that the relationship between the federal and state governments has also made the actually just developing an adequate number of tests available problematic.
We're talking to Phil Rocco, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at health insurance and general public health preparedness and coordination during the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how the government is dealing with health insurance providers of various sorts, legislation in the works in Congress? What do you want to see from the federal government, from the state government when it comes to provision of testing, coverage of treatment? If you work in healthcare, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the health insurance industry and healthcare policy during the coronavirus outbreak. Phil Rocco is with us, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on who should be paying for testing, for treatment of COVID-19. What do you want to see, if anything, from the federal government when it comes to mandating that providers cover these things? Do you have questions for our guest about how all this works or what's in the works in the legislature, in Congress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Phil, you've tweeted some about our public health infrastructure, our readiness, our coordination. What do you think as we are in the midst of this thing?
Well, I mean, I think so. Public health is a very deep in the weeds topic, right? Mm. It's something that we don't recognize. It's like you don't recognize the infrastructure because it's, you know, working much of the time and there aren't a lot of major emergencies like this. But it's important to think about our public health system gives very, very different roles to different levels of government. So at the federal level, that is really where the research gets done. That is where some of the guidelines are developed. And that's where a lot of the sort of surveillance of public health, monitoring the progression of viruses happen. It's not where a lot of the authority and the capacity live to actually do the things like provide tests, to close down public facilities where there are going to be large numbers of people in attendance. All of those powers, those sort of protective powers, live at the state and sometimes local levels. And so, you know, while the CDC can publish some research about smoking and some guidelines about smoking. For the most part, when it comes to regulating clean indoor air, that happens at the state and local levels. What that means is when state and local governments, public health organizations are not adequately funded and resourced, it creates real vulnerabilities and risk for our ability to respond to public health emergencies, and often creates this lag where we're waiting for federal resources to come in to really ramp up the testing and a lot of the action that to the extent that we might need to. And so I think that it's just an important thing to keep in mind is that different levels of government have different responsibilities. I think the problem that creates for the average citizen, the average voter, is, you know, where do you go when you're looking for information about what you should do? And I think this is one place where the coordination of action between federal and state and local governments is really important. And it's where, in my perception of what's been going on lately, it's where some of the most confusion has come in. And I think now we're starting to see state governments really rise to the occasion and step up and provide much clearer information to people. But this is where I think, you know, a week or so ago, the federal government's language and its sort of framing of this event was very tenuous and very difficult for most people to understand. And I think that ultimately when you have a virus that's progressing this quickly and with so much uncertainty, the most important thing is even at a more fundamental level than the legislation that we pass or the, what material we're able to get out there, is some sense of guidance for what people should do and, you know, how concerned they should be and how they should respond. And I think that that's one of the greatest things that we should learn from this is, you know, how do we communicate about risk and who should we entrust to do that?
Let's bring on our callers now. Rich starts us off in Lake Geneva. Rich, hello.
Thank you for taking my call. I guess I have a big picture look at this, and I certainly don't have all the answers or many answers at all, but I'm hearing more and more talk that seems to indicate to me that everyone's looking for the federal government to fix this and take care of all of the consequences that result from this illness. Wherever it started, we don't know, or all of those things, but I'm hearing constant talk of the federal government should do something and they should be, I heard today Mitt Romney's talking about a bill that would give $1,000 to every person in the country for the impact of this. Our federal government is running at a massive deficit, and they're not doing some of the things they really have to do. And when we look to them to do...
Gotcha. Rich, thanks. Phil, Rich saying we're relying too much on the federal government here.
Yeah, I think I completely understand Rich's point. And, you know, you wonder, we have different levels of government. Who's really responsible for what? But I think that when it comes to the issue of the economic response to coronavirus, one thing that the federal government can do that state and local governments can't do is that it actually has the power to deficit spend, and it has access to the Federal Reserve. And that is, it's those tools that it has of monetary and fiscal policy that allow the federal government to act what, you know, economists in the economist language, countercyclically, meaning when a crisis happens, those tools enable the federal government to kick in and actually begin to address some of these. I mean, we're only at the beginning of seeing just how massive the economic fallout. We could be losing 5% of GDP by the end of the second quarter. Pretty massive, even conservative estimates of how bad the economic loss could be for businesses and individuals, workers. And so I think that, you know, when it comes to thinking about what are the proper roles of different levels of government, it's an important question. But I think when it comes to which level of the government are best equipped with the tools that they have to respond to something like an economic calamity or economic fallout. That's one place where I think there's a reason why we're seeing both Republicans and Democrats try to evaluate the tools that they have, because their constituents and the businesses in their states are going to be hit very, very hard by this if it goes on as long as many scientists suggest that it will.
Rick, thanks for that call. We'll go to Nancy now in Minocqua. Nancy, hello.
Hi. Yes, I'm one of those uninsured Americans, and I definitely feel that if the federal government can bail out the cruise industry, the airlines, the banks, stock markets, they sure can pay for everybody to get tested, and they can sure pay for their treatment. I mean, I'm a waitress, and I'm not going to have any money coming in because of this.
Nancy, thanks a lot for the call, Phil. Yeah, double whammy for a lot of people, uninsured as Nancy is, and losing work, probably losing money from week to week. Is there a thought? Do you see a focus at the federal level toward helping people in Nancy's kind of position?
Yeah, I have to admit, Nancy, that when this first emerged, when the scale of this first emerged, that was the first thought that I had, because this is many people that I know personally are going to be affected in just that way. They don't have insurance, and they're worried about actually being laid off, and some of them have been laid off. And I think that in the legislation that Congress is putting through right now, there are some provisions for extending paid sick leave, but they don't cover those provisions, for example, don't cover people who work for firms with more than 500 people, which is an extensive part of the labor force that's left out. And so, again, this is one of these places where I think that if we go back and look at the history of other major crises, like the Great Depression, the real place where the response starts is with people talking about the concrete material realities of what is happening to them. Because I think it's those things that actually frame the response. And so I think it's important that, public radio, that other sort of media institutions that we have actually begin talking about what the lived economic reality of this is for people like Nancy and millions of people throughout the country, because that's ultimately what should set the context for how we should respond, not sort of abstractions about it, but the real concrete realities.
Just in our last 20 seconds or so, Phil, what are you watching for next?
I mean, I'm really looking at this as a sort of, at minimum, three-part crisis. One is, how fast can we move to ensure that there's not more community spread? How fast can state and local governments move to take action that will flatten the curve, including closing public accommodations? Second is an economic crisis, and I think that's related to the first one, but how quickly are we going to be able to mobilize a federal economic response? And how quickly are we going to be able to overcome some of those congressional hurdles? The third thing is, I think it's going to be a political crisis. We're looking at states, increasing number of states, delaying elections or rapidly changing elections in ways that could have major effects on turnout. And so how are we responding to the emergency that comes about in our democracy from this? So I think it's those three things. I think they're related to one another in ways that are really complicated. But this is a time to really pay attention to what's going on.
Phil, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thanks. Great to be here.
That's Philip Rocco, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He's author of the book Obamacare Wars. He joined us for a look at health coverage, healthcare policy, and the COVID-19 pandemic. Tomorrow on Central Time, a doctor joins the show to answer your questions about COVID-19, public health efforts, and what you can do to help stop the spread of the illness. That, and a look at some of the other big news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.